Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Adloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief, as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Hey Griefsters! I hope you're having, I hope you're having an okay week, as I say every week. Thank you so much for listening. If you have been enjoying this series of the Griefcast, please do remember you can rate and review on Apple Podcasts if you have been enjoying it, and you can rate and review individual episodes. It just helps other people find the show, makes a big difference. Also, just to let you know, we are going to be at Latitude Festival, which is very exciting. We're going to be there on the Sunday at 1 o'clock in the podcast tent. I think it's called the Listening Post. So you can find us. It will be me. Talking to three other comedians, yet to be confirmed, about death and funerals and the usual live episode fun. So if you're going to be at Latitude, do come and find us there. This week, a very special live episode with the brilliant comedians Greg Davis and Barry Castagnola. We recorded this episode in Leicester in conjunction with Dying Matters Week, which was in May, and also to raise funds for Loros Hospice in Leicestershire. Loros is an amazing hospice which Greg is a patron of. It supports 2,500 terminally ill patients and their loved ones every year, and they offer all sorts of holistic services. There's day therapies, there's this beautiful huge room where they can come and do craft and talk to each other, and it's just a really welcoming, amazing place. We had a little tour of it, and it was not what you, I think, some people think of hospices. You know, it's a really positive, beautiful place. It costs £8 million to run Loros every year, and £6 million of which is relied on through voluntary income. So, yeah, it's shocking, isn't it? You always sort of think hospices are just there, but obviously they're there because people volunteer and raise funds and do things like Greg is doing to raise awareness of them. But it was a really, really wonderful chat that we had. Both Greg and Barry have lost their dads, and so obviously it was very focused on the Dead Dad Club for this episode. We recorded it just at a cafe in Leicester, which they gave us for the night, and there was some music beforehand and cakes and tea and drink, and it was just a really lovely opportunity to talk about death in a positive way, which is obviously what we try and do with this show. So I hope you enjoy.
Hello. Hi everyone. Hi, I'm Carrie Ad.
Thank you so much for coming. Does anyone listen to the show? Don't worry if you don't. Yeah. Oh, great. Some people are aware of what this is going to be. If you don't listen to the show, don't worry. Oh, hi, up in the expensive seats. Hi. So basically, we're just going to have a chat about death and grief in a very relaxed, easy way. If we have time for Q&A, we might have some questions at the end. Okay, so I'm going to bring on down to the stage two very excellent comedians. Please put your hands together, everybody, for Greg Davis and Barry Castagnola, everybody. Look at this. Da 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 da. Please sit down. It felt a bit like Wogan. Didn't they used to walk downstairs like that, Wogan?
We were in a room just there. I'm not quite sure why we were...
No, why we had to...
We had to go up to make some dramatic entrance for you, but I liked it.
Pretty showbiz.
It was very showbiz, and it's good to start chats about death in showbiz fashion. So I'm going to go straight in there, because that's what the job of this is. Greg, is death something you think about a lot? Are you somebody who worries about it, has, like, death anxiety, or you...
Yeah.
You do?
I would say I'm weirdly obsessed by it.
Welcome.
But not so much about myself. I don't really know how I feel about the inevitability that I'm going to die. But I am obsessed with it in a way that perhaps you can help me work out.
Sure.
In that there isn't a dead person who's achieved any level of fame that I can't tell you how they died.
Oh, really?
And I don't know why. I've even asked a psychotherapist why.
So you like to find out how they died?
Yeah. And where they were at in their life when they died.
Okay, so who's your favourite so far at the moment of, like...
I don't know whether I have a death, because I'm not sort of amused by how they died.
No, but who's I'm glad I know that.
Well, I have such an encyclopedic knowledge of celebrity death.
Justin, try it.
Yeah, I'm trying to think now. Like, okay.
And don't go in easy. Don't go on an Elvis or something
like
that.
No, I wasn't going to Elvis.
Test me.
Steve Jobs.
Oh, cancer.
Oh, but what type of cancer?
Okay, pancreatic.
Oh, good work.
Thank you. You're not going to dissect me with those little tools, mate.
But what, like, did you, like, work... But you said, is it just how they died? That's your obsession?
Yeah, and I'm joking, but I don't know why. I don't know what the morbid interest is, but there's obviously, you know, there is some fascination with the way the stage that people are at in life when they shuffle off this morbid coil.
How old is he then?
Jobs.
Yeah.
I don't know his exact age, but I never claim to be able to know their ages.
Oh, okay. So not that specific. Barry, is it something you think about every day, or is it, like, not on your brain?
It's not something I worry about. I don't think. I think my lifestyle is testament to that. I think less than worrying about actually dying, it's more of a worry of not fitting in enough into life.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If there's certain things that you feel you should have achieved. You know what I mean? There was genuinely a little while ago, I was going through my Sky Plus and thought, I don't think I'm going to watch everything on here. and let alone read all the books that I've got.
Right,
and there's just stuff like that I just feel... Yeah. I feel it's not so much a worry about dying, it's a real worry about time just passing by too quickly another year older.
I think that sort of weirdly ties into my obsession.
Okay.
I think it does, but because it's not that I'm interested in how a celebrity died per se, it's more that it's on record of where they were,
what they'd achieved,
and what level of happiness they were at in their life. And because that information is accessible.
Yeah.
So it's not so much about the celebrity, it's more about...
The amount that you can know about someone
once
they're dead.
Yeah. I did Who Do You Think You Are, and we got stuck into death records then
of
people from my family
and
what point they were at when they passed, and started to unfold these sort of miniature dramas of people who are long dead.
Yeah.
And I am obsessed with that sort of detail. And I think it ties in with, did they get to do everything they wanted to do?
Interesting, because sometimes I think there's the point of death. So I think you're either obsessed with the living bit or, like, the death bit or the after bit. Do you know what I mean? And I think I'm really obsessed with, like, dying, just the act of dying. Like, how's it going to happen? When's it going to happen? Like, I want to, but doing stuff before that, I'm not so bothered about, because I sort of think it doesn't really matter, you're still going to die. I think,
so are you worried about how it's...
Oh yeah, I've got death anxiety massively. It's like literally, I interviewed a guest called Lauren Silver, who was so obsessed with it, she made her psychotherapist give her a term, and then they were like, you've got death anxiety, and I was like, yes, me too, now I've got name for it. But it's quite common if you've lost a parent as a teenager, because you've lost a foundation very young, so you don't trust anything. Because you're a bit like, anything could go at any point.
Right.
Because you didn't really get to a ripe old age before something massive happened.
Do you find that then makes you, I'm going to live each day like it's the last, but do you feel like because of the, you think about the fragility of life, that you try and do more?
I don't think I do more. I think I get a bit zen about it. I'm like, it doesn't matter what you do, you're going to die. So it doesn't matter how much, you'll always have books, you'll always have too many films to read, you'll never make all the friends, you'll never see all the countries. Like, it's just this inevitability of death. It's just there. So that's my obsession, is like, how can we be reading about these people dying when you're going to die?
Yeah.
Do you think you're avoiding it by looking at the famous people?
Well, no, I think I think for all the time I've spent thinking about death, I could have read a couple of extra good books. I genuinely do think it's a waste of time, and it's not something that I'm... Oh. It's not an aspect of my character that I enjoy, that often I'll go down that rabbit hole of wondering about an end of life. I do think it's a waste of my time, and it frustrates me.
Why do you think it's a waste? Just because it's going to happen?
Well, there's an inevitability to it, and there are things that you can do to perhaps, you know, slow it down, but it's going to happen.
Yeah.
But I think if I wrote down, if I timed the amount of time that I give to thinking about death, it's time wasted.
I think I get anxious, like I say, with the aging process, because in my mind is that there'll be a point where, and I know it's a generational thing as well, but I'm... You know, I haven't got kids, and I feel like I look at, say, my mum and dad particularly got married. My dad died at 58, but my mum and dad were married. My dad was, I think, 21 when he had my brother. So when I look to him and think when he was this age, he'd been through two divorces. He had a second marriage with another kid, and I go, I'm behind here.
It terrifies
me. There's been points in your life where you go... You know, there's a point when I suddenly went, oh my God, most of the football players that I admire, I am older than. And now,
twice
managers.
Age. Twice the age.
There was a while ago where I'm a Tottenham fan, and our manager, Maurizio, I absolutely love our football manager. And it was the first football manager I really properly admire. And I remember saying to a friend of mine, going, look at the way he's with the players. And I go, I wish he was my dad. I wish he was, and he went, and there's an opening. And I said, for the position. And I said, I wish he was my dad. And then he went, he's 2 years older than you.
Yeah.
But it doesn't feel like it.
I worked out that when my dad was my age, I was 45. It feels like it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was a fully formed adult
when
my dad was my age. And I don't have kids either, so that...
But it feels like there's so much still to do.
It feels like the clock ticks... loudly.
Do you think that the other thing I think is because we don't talk about death so much, because it is this sort of like weird subject, like then you sort of have to like hide away or obsess about other aspects of it. Like, whereas if we talked about it more, perhaps do you think you'd be more, like to both of you, do you think you'd be more comfortable where you are? Because death wouldn't be like this, fuck it, when is it going to come? It'd be like, of course it's going to come.
I think the difference between talking about death and thinking about death is marked. I would draw a big distinction between me disappearing down a wormhole thinking about death on my own and having an open conversation about it in terms of value.
Yeah.
I mean, it's far, talking about it, sharing stories of it is not at all time wasted.
You talk about it all the time. You've still got death anxiety.
I know.
You do a podcast.
I'm on episode 80 of my podcast, and I still have death anxiety. But it has got not better, I won't lie. But it's definitely, I've got more aware, and more aware when it's happening. Whereas before the podcast, before I talked about death on a weekly basis, I think I was like, I didn't think it was death anxiety. I thought, I think I know when people are going to die. And I need
you thought you had a superpower.
I have a superpower. Right. I know when they're going to die. And obviously, it didn't with my dad. It was a bit of a shock. So I could have turned it on then. So I sort of thought, I need to worry for them because they're going to die and they don't realise. So I'd be like, careful crossing that road, Barry. And then you'd be like, what is wrong with you? Like, in case you die. And that would be, whereas now I think, don't say that to Barry. It's probably a bit weird.
Yeah. And was that a lot more intense when you were a teenager after your dad died?
Specifically about Barry.
This event is designed to make Barry aware that I'm worried about him. His road safety is poor. Okay? Left, right, left again, Barry. If you died that way, that's awful, isn't it? That's what I now worry about. There'd be this recording of me predicting, but then my superpower would be true, so that'd be fine. Okay. Yeah, it was intense as a teenager, but I didn't have the words for it. So I just thought I was worrying. And then you think, well, worries are valid, aren't they? They're because you should be worried about things. So this must be a valid worry that everyone's going to die. And I'm one of those people, like, if someone doesn't text me back, they're dead. Like, that's what I think.
They're dead to you.
They're dead to me. Not text me back. But if we arrange to meet and you're 5 minutes late, my first thought is, you've been killed.
Something's awful.
Oh, yeah. Oh, like, you've been. And then I go through it in my head of, like, various ways. And then when you arrive, I'm like, oh.
That is very much in my family's, all of my family. That's how we all behave.
Yeah.
There's a missed text or a missed call. Mm. And I know, and she won't mind me saying it comes directly from my mum. Mm. Throughout childhood, if we woke my mum up, if she was asleep, and we woke her up just to tell her we were going out, she would wake up like this. What? What? Because I was waking her up. And if I ring her now and she's not expecting a call, it's always, what's wrong?
Yeah. Oh, my God, what's happened?
Yeah.
Nothing. I was just trying to say, oh, all right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mickey Flanagan used to have that lovely line about when you only just had, before mobiles, and you just had the one phone that used to be kept on a little round table in the hallway. Yeah. And he said, if it rang after 9 o'clock, he's going to, mum would go, who's that calling this time? Someone had better have died.
It's so true. So, speaking of death, Barry, how do you want to go? Have you thought about this?
Yeah, I mean, in my sleep.
And you say that's the dream, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah, literally. I don't really want to know about it. It's interesting the way different people deal with dying when they know they're dying. My dad, when he passed away, he had pancreatic cancer. It's weird, pancreatic cancer.
We've not talked about both our dads have pancreatic cancer.
Yeah, it's not the most. Wow. It's not the most common of cancers. I mean, it's not
the fifth most common.
Is it fifth? Is it right?
It receives the least amount of funding, guys.
Yeah, but I ran a marathon for once. Yeah. But it's a bit like once you hear about it, it's a bit like when you buy a car. And then suddenly you see all those cars on the road. Suddenly you hear loads of people where you notice how many people have got...
Steve Jobs, Patrick Swayze, there's our gang, guys.
Bill Hicks. Arabella Churchill, Winston Churchill's granddaughter.
Yeah, was she pancreatic?
She was pancreatic, yeah.
Great club.
let me just store all
this. Who else, Greg?
I've got that in the database.
I didn't know your dad was pancreatic. And I made a joke on telly once that it was one of the, like, it was the worst one. Some of the other cancer people didn't like that joke, guys. They got really good.
No, but it's
just because it's very... It has no symptoms, basically. So, like, people who get it tend to die...
They don't know until quite late.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's got, like, it's like a 5% survival rate. And it's interesting... sorry, I know I'm going off topic. You asked me how I was going. But with the way that other people deal with grief, and with particularly if it's a terminal illness, and again, everyone deals with things differently. There's no right way, but... What used to annoy me a little bit was when people were telling me to be positive, right? It just really wound me up because I was thinking, I've looked at the stats.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not going into my dad, you know, in hospital and going, not looking good for you, Dad. 5%, woo, you know.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think me being positive myself, I understand if you've got the illness or you've got, and there's negative energy within your body, I can buy that. But me not being part of that, and that just sort of annoyed me a bit. But then he had there's a thing called a Whipple surgery if you've got pancreatic cancer, and you have, I was going to say, you have to be lucky enough, that's a ridiculous one. But if the tumour's in a certain place at the top, they can
operate, which is very rare.
Yes,
very
so he was able to have the Whipple surgery. So then you're suddenly going, it was like, whoa, we've actually... Yeah. maybe this is the one time, because he wasn't very lucky, my dad, generally, you know, but he used to say it himself, his thing, you know, when your dad's always got that one little dad joke and saying, yeah. Oh, I'm so unlucky. He goes, I'm so unlucky. I could fall into a bucket of nipples and still come out sucking my thumb. Apologies.
All the little vignettes you thought you were going to hear tonight about death. Nobody expected that one.
So I do apologise.
I would argue if you fell into a bucket of disembodied nipples.
Yeah, it's horrendous. Yeah.
And you came up sucking your thumb, you've had a right result.
Yeah, no, I would.
I love that saying.
But he had the surgery. So for a second you were like, oh my god, this is amazing. You know, we've got hope. But then had test a few weeks later and got into lymph nodes and all that. But you know, the point being, he said the minute it's looking like it's fairly imminent, he was like, because he went from the hospital and went back home and had sort of palliative care at home, and he said, I don't want to know about it. I want to medicate me up. I don't want. He's gone, I'm not going to be sitting on the bed giving speeches to everyone. He said, and a friend of his father had passed away not that long before and did that whole thing, having all the family around him, and he went, no, get me off my face. I don't want to know anything about it.
I think that's an interesting, they're not wanting to talk about it. The person who's dying not wanting to talk about it.
It's
an interesting area. It was for me when my dad was clearly...
How did your dad die?
Well, he sort of had a protracted, drawn-out death. He had a stroke,
right.
And then he recovered from the stroke, and then it turned into dementia, but vascular dementia.
Right.
And in my dad's case, it sort of came and went. It was
a
sort of ebb and flow dementia, so that sometimes he was absolutely as lucid as we're being now, and sometimes he could barely speak. But that would change from day to day. And he became hugely immobile. Now, what I was going to say was I wanted to talk about it with him. It was obviously not far away, although it's very non-specific. He had a multiple conditions, but there was no sort of one thing. You know, I know your dad was given a time scale, wasn't he? There wasn't that with my dad, but it was so obviously...
on his way,
imminent.
And the journey, yeah.
And I wanted to talk to him about it, and he would absolutely no way did he want to engage in any kind of conversation.
Would he just change the subject? Or would
It made me be quite angry.
Oh, really?
Because I'm not going to talk about it.
Wow.
Yeah, and my mum tried to raise the idea of where his ashes should be and what he wanted, and he was, I couldn't care less. Do what you want with them. I'm not talking about it. And there was never I'm trying to think of a way of phrasing it without making it. There was never a sort of, come and sit here, son, let's have this.
And have the conversation where you acknowledge I'm dying.
But I think, looking back on it, it's a selfish want from you as a child. Maybe fed to you by films that the person who's leaving is going to do some sort of inspirational speech.
Yeah.
And really, all my dad was saying was, I don't want to die.
Yeah,
every time I spoke to him, he was, I don't want to die. And
my dad didn't acknowledge it either.
Yeah.
And he was in, not a hospice, a hospital. I got confused for about 2 years. My mum corrected me the other week. He was in the cancer ward of a hospital. And I remember, this must have been like probably about 5 days before he died. And obviously you're a teenager as well, so it's even more difficult. Like, I didn't really have any difficult conversations with him because I was like, I don't know where to begin.
Yeah.
But my mum was saying, like, Pete, you need to tell us what we're going to do with the ashes. And he was like, right, next week we need to book tickets. We're going to Boston. I've got that conference there. Then we're going to go to Scotland. And I remember as a teenager being like, is he? Like, what is he on? Like, and I thought, my God, he's just, like, complete denial. Like, just, this is not happening. And then sadly, I think by the time he realised he wasn't in a position to actually have a conversation, he became too sick to talk. And I felt for years so angry that he didn't talk to me about it. And I agree with you, it is the selfish want of a child. Also, I mean, I have 15-year-old anger, so I am more angry. You know, I'm more think, irrational.
I was going to say, I think there's a big gulf between
exactly.
a man in his late 40s.
But I do think it's a shame. I agree with you. You're never going to get the Hollywood moment. We say this on the show all the time. Like, the Hollywood moment does not exist.
Did either of your dads...
This is the Dead Dad Club, by the way. Yeah. So we're doing really well.
Did either of your dads... ever fall into a bucket of nipples? No. No. Did do you not
Weirdly,
do you not
yeah.
think do you not think in some ways my dad as well, he didn't talk, but he clung on to me. It was the one thing that stayed with me for a long time after. I found it hard. One time it was just me and him, and my dad lived in America, he lived in California, so I was sort of to in and fro in during that process, and I spent about 15 weeks out there on and off, including the final sort of 7 weeks. So in some ways, everything was magnified, because if it's happening at home, you're still, to an extent, going about your daily business. Of course, it's always with you, but you might be going to work or doing whatever, where we were just sat there, you know, but the one thing I really remember was him just grabbing onto me at one point and crying and saying, I don't want to go. Yeah. And I think... I don't know how much I'd want to talk about it myself.
Yeah.
I know it's inevitable, but I sort of think, you know, and hearing what you both say about it, I don't think I would really want to.
I don't think it's about going into the detail. I think it was just to acknowledge it.
Right.
I would have liked a moment where we acknowledged that this wasn't going to go on forever. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I definitely felt like I wanted him to acknowledge he was dying, and then I felt like, do you have anything to say? Like, as your child, is there anything you want? Anything you want to pass on or not? And it doesn't have to be this big inspirational moment, but I felt, and obviously it's very different. I felt like you're the adult, can't you? Like, can't you?
Aren't you going to pass on some wisdom?
Get yourself together and like say something to me.
Yeah.
Because I'm always coming from grief as a 15-year-old. I'm stuck in that moment.
Yeah.
Like, for fuck's sake, what are you doing again? Like.
But to be honest, Carrie, I went through exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
If I'm really honest, I went through the same thing of having moments of of thinking, you selfish old man. When are you going to tell me how great I am?
I just wanted
how proud you are, or something. But then I would catch myself and I would think about them. I'm lucky that I had him a lot longer than you had your dad. But I think the multitude of times he told me how proud he was of me, and the multitude of times that he gave me amazing advice, and I felt ashamed of myself for being irritated with him.
But I don't, that's the thing I think is interesting. I'm just saying this, but I don't think you should feel ashamed, because I think so much of what it is that push and pull of love. So, like, the want... It's both of you saying, I don't want you to die, really. And I think that's why it's like, it's okay to be frustrated with someone who's dying, because the problem is we then feel ashamed and we feel guilty, and then we go like, oh, don't talk about it, rather than going, yeah, I got annoyed with him even when he was dying, because that was our dynamic.
Yeah.
And it would have been really weird if suddenly I wasn't, because I suddenly became an angel teenager and he became an angel father. Like, and he wasn't. He was quite annoying.
It's amazing that... To say that the people who are dying can be irritating is such a strange thing. But I mean, my dad was, you know, I'm sure he would say himself at times was a sensationally irritating ill man.
And emotions are high.
Of course. Well, so everything's turned up.
So everything, you know, there were big rows with my brother and my sister during even in the sort of day after he finally died. There was a huge, huge row. And actually, think about the way that my dad actually acknowledged it was generally through dark humour, and I think it was a massive help. There's certain things that we went to go and buy him
the blender.
We went to go and buy him a Nutribullet. We went down to the supermarket, and the woman on the checkout said to him, do you want the additional 12-month warranty with this? And he paused and went, you haven't got a 3-month one, have you? And, you know, there was moments like that really stick with me as being, just being really funny. And also, he sort of didn't do any of that, you know, he'd had a big argument with his brother years and years ago, and that wasn't resolved. And even when he sort of could have, and he came up with some really harsh comments that made me go, ah, oh, that's my dad. Do you know what I mean? Rather than, oh, yeah, he's going to do this, like, you know, he's not going to do the Hollywood ending. He's not going to resolve anything. He's going to still be bitter about this falling out with his brother till the end. And it sort of felt, I don't know, felt right.
But I think that's really important.
His brother was bang out of order.
That's the person you know and love. And if they suddenly start, you know, becoming, and I think that's the problem that I had after he died, people started going, oh, you know, and he was this, he was that. And I was like, who are you talking about?
Yeah.
Like, he was a human and, yeah, he was really great in some ways, and he was also really annoying, and I want all of that to be remembered because that's my dad. But when people started going, oh, and you know, he was a wonderful father, I was like, nah, I mean, there were issues. And I think that's okay, because that's the person I loved, was the flawed person. I couldn't, when he became saint, and especially, well, you want to become a saint, die young and have two children who are quite young at the same time, like, everyone was like, oh, what a man. I was like, this is weird. That's not the truth of it.
My dad had a succession of carers. He sort of got used to a couple of carers and got on well with them, and that was okay. Then they got changed. I can't remember why. It was some funding issue. I don't know, but they changed, and a lady came round. It's not unfair to say one of the new carers wasn't especially bright. Unlike all of the other wonderful carers, this one lady spoke to my dad like he was an infant, like he was a toddler.
Yeah, yeah.
She was raising her voice when there was nothing wrong with his hearing. Right. One of the few things that was fucking working. And she was going, how are you? And he was going, I'm fine. Well, I'm not fine. And then she saw that there was a toy go-kart for my nieces in the garden, and she said, my son's got one of those, and when we bought it for him, he drove it round and round and round all morning. We couldn't get him off it. And my dad looked at her and went, I mean, that is a shit story. And I felt this surge of pride. And it was like, there he is, he's back in the room.
The bit that you love is the personality of a person. If someone starts going, oh, they were just wonderful, you're like, that's not who they were.
No, I love
those. Very nice stories. My dad pretended to be dead. That's dark, isn't it?
When
he was in the hospital. Sort of, like, we came in the room and he went like, and did this, and then went, got ya.
Yeah.
I was like, are you fucking kidding me?
My brother and I, and my sister was just, again, was sat, my dad was pretty much unconscious for the last 5 days or so, and had given us instructions to medicate him up, to the point where the palliative care nurses were just like, I'm shocked he's still here.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And this is just straight. So days off days, and we don't want to leave the bedside at this point. So we were just amusing ourselves in different ways, and there was some horse racing on TV. My brother's a huge, he even moved to Kentucky to work with horses there. He's obsessed with horse racing. So my brother's trying to keep things, he's full of energy. My brother's going, right, okay, right, is it dollar bills from you? And my dad's friend was there as well. So he's taking all our dollar bills, and he's looked around, and my dad's laying there like that, and he put the money under my dad's hands while we watched the race, and then just paused and looked around and went, it's like Weekend at Bernie's. So there was a lot of dark humour.
I think that again, that's the thing why I kind of started the podcast. Like, I think lots of people do have dark humour at that time, and then when you get out of it, when you sort of, you know, reach the end of it and they're dead, and you're sort of coming back into real life, everyone sort of acts like, oh no, of course we wouldn't have done any jokes while they were there, but you have, and then we all feel guilty about it, and you're like, if we all admitted, oh yeah, we were all laughing. There was times in that hospital room with me and my mum and my brother, we were laughing because it was so fucking weird.
Well, I did a whole routine in my last show about the day he died. I won't repeat it now, but no, I won't. But you know, in the day he died in that hospital room, there was a stage where we were all crying with laughter because of an inept nurse actually came in and said the wrong thing, and we were all crying with laughter.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is funny, and I don't think there's one person who's not going to thank me for telling you this. When my dad was clearly, I mean, he's probably already dead, to be honest, in hospital. Looking back on it, he was taken to hospital. I think he was It was just, he was just breathing. I think he probably died at home, is what we all think.
Yeah.
But he was still the whatever apparatus within the body keeps the breath going. He was still technically alive, but it was clearly he wasn't going to get better. My mum had an awful panic attack. Well, what turned out to be a form of panic attack, but she's had heart problems herself. And I guess through lack of sleep and stress,
yeah, of course.
She had to be... this isn't funny, I know it is. So while my dad was dying, she had to be rushed into A&E.
Oh, God.
And wired up to check her heart, because she'd already had a heart attack.
Oh,
so they thought she was having another heart attack.
Yeah.
And while she was in there, I was stroking her head. My sister was with Dad. And I remember thinking, this is the worst possible situation to be in life. We're going to lose both of them at the same time. And I was stroking my mum's head, trying to play the adult. And after about 5 minutes, I looked at my mum and I went, is this nice? And she went, no. She opened one eye and she went, no. It's irritating. And it really made me laugh because it told me that she was back in the room.
She was back in the room. She's away. Yeah. And that's what we always say on the show. Like, somebody dying, obviously, is not hilarious, but things that happen around someone's death can be absolutely hilarious.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with finding humour in those moments because, and I say it's like finding pearls in shit, like, the rest of it's so fucking awful. Why shouldn't you have a moment where you laugh and relax and enjoy it? Because you're dealing with this unbelievably painful thing. I don't think, and I think that's the thing I've noticed, like, comedians tend to be more like, oh yeah, this was funny, but people who don't work in comedy will sort of whisper to me like, oh, we did laugh because this thing happened, like, don't tell anyone. I'm like, we should all admit that, like, funny stuff happens. It's okay. It's absolutely okay.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
So how long ago did your dad die then?
So my dad died in 2008. So we had...
So you've just had like 10 years then?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. How was that?
It was tough, actually. The 10-year particularly was...
I found 10 really hard, yeah.
What was tough. And his birthday and the day that he died were about sort of 10 days apart. So, I had his... had his birthday... and it was difficult, and also because my brother and my sister both live in America, and they were both busy. I didn't get to speak to them, and I left them a couple of messages, and so I was sort of, I was very upset about it being a 10-year anniversary of my dad and thinking about my dad, but also a bit upset and angry, I'll be honest, with my brother and sister, feeling like that they should have been there. We should have been, because I think sometimes you expect people to act in how you want them to act, and they don't always, and you're sort of like, why aren't you? I'm desperate to speak to you, my brother and sister. Why aren't you answering my calls? So that was upsetting.
It's really hard because the process of grief Like, we can say everyone in this room will grieve differently, but when it's very difficult and challenging is when it's different in a family. And I think that can be really hard because you're like, but we have the same dad, what's wrong with you? Like, and like, me and my brother had this running joke for years. I would literally have to text him, it was the anniversary. Because he was like, I just can't remember it. And I was like, how can you not remember it? Like, who doesn't remember? And then, well, I started interviewing people on Griefcast. And I started meeting people who go, I can't remember the date. And then he texted me and was like, I've just listened. And turns out Jen can't remember the date either, so it's all right that I can't remember the date. And I was like, oh, I see. You know, people, the date for me is very important. That anniversary is really important. But for him, he made a mental decision at 19, to be fair, of just going, I just don't want that day to hover, so I'm going to blank it out. I know it's somewhere in April, and that's all I'm going to do.
I think I made the same decision and very much took the lead in my family. And you saying that, I've never actually spoken to my mum and sister about how they feel about that, because I consciously don't mark the date.
Yeah.
And I consciously don't mark my dad's birthday either.
Yeah.
And I think the reason is that my grandmother, my dad's mum, she lost her husband. He died when my dad was 21 or something. So she lost him when he was 50.
Yeah.
I don't know. 53. And she marked the day every year with a week of mourning up to the date.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it was a big thing in the family, and I think subconsciously I never liked that.
Yeah.
I don't like a day of sadness being on the horizon, because I think that, for me anyway, and I'm sure for lots of other people, that the miracle of the grieving process is that imperceptibly, that the times that you remember, the times I remember my dad, imperceptibly moved from sad, sad, happy, sad, 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 into happy. So that nearly every time I remember him now, I'm filled with joy and happiness. Nearly every time. And I don't want there to be a sad milestone on the calendar. And so I've told Mum and Sian, and I must ask them how they feel about
it. They might be meeting without you. That's what me and Mum do.
they certainly might be talking without Mum. Yeah. I mean, I do talk. I'm not a monster about it. I do acknowledge it when I talk to my mum. Yeah, I acknowledge it's the day. But for me, the day really means nothing.
Yeah.
And it really does. The only reason I would mention it is because I think perhaps Mum would want me to.
Yeah. And that's what I've learned doing the show, is that to me, that day, it's not a day of sadness. It's just, for me, it feels like it's just a moment to take stock and be like, it was today, it was 10 years ago, it was 15 years, and I find that day really, I do find it sad, but I sort of enjoy that I know that's the day, I can feel shit that day, and I'm allowed, and I can remember it, and I can think about him, and I can just have that moment and be like, okay, that's where I'm at. But my brother feels exactly the same. He was like, why do I want this, you know, this day of sadness? But I don't see, you know, again, it's so personal, and that's...
Of course, believe me, I'm not suggesting for a second that my system is the correct system.
No.
And I'm not suggesting that my grandmother was to be criticised for, you know, you must do it however it suits you.
Yeah,
but I voiced to them early doors, I don't want there to be this cloud on the horizon. Let's talk about him and let's celebrate him. And, you know, but I don't want to,
I've also had anniversary years where... depending on what I'm doing as well, where obviously I've thought about it, but haven't been sort of racked with grief that day. And then other times where, so just say although my dad lived in America, we used to speak every day, I think, on the phone. Certainly it would be unusual if we didn't speak 5 or 6 times in a week.
Wow.
And we were sort of like best mates. It was a father-son, but more of a best mate relationship. So if I was driving back doing comedy gigs up north somewhere, because of the time difference in America, and he had like 3 calls in the UK, so I'd sit and I'd have like a hands-free kit. I'm driving on it can be really boring drive, as you know, driving back from late night gigs and having a good laugh, chatting with my dad. So it left a real emptiness.
Yeah.
And then certain times would be, you know, just as you think you're getting over it, again, everyone here has obviously dealt with grief in some way, and it's almost like, you know, pools of sorrow, waves of grief hitting you, you know, just bang, where you just get it out of nowhere. You've been listening to something on the radio. I remember once I think it was Rory McIlroy or someone had won a golf competition, was talking about how proud their father or something, and it's like, and it just hits you.
Yeah.
And I went back to it, well, I've been back a few times, but there was a particular road that I was driving on when I was out in America a couple of months ago, and I suddenly realised I was right near where my dad used to live, but I'd sort of taken a back road because the sat-nav would take me around the wrong way, so I didn't recognise. And suddenly, and I sat outside the house that he was in, and that was really hard, and sort of just hit me with uncontrollable sobbing for a second, which I hadn't had for a long time. It felt unusual because
was it entirely sad?
It was, but it was also happy times from where they lived there. But it was just, it was sad. The loss was sad, coupled with remembering happy times at that particular house. Because my dad had a lot of ups and downs over his life, you know, and that was a particularly happy time. But it was sort of nostalgic and very upsetting at the same time. And it's just funny how it can just whack you.
Oh God, yeah. And I think that's really important, that, you know, the grief process or journey, however you want to label it. Like, I definitely found, I was so surprised that, like, 10 years the same. I was like, what, why should it matter? Why should 10 be a thing? But
right.
Last year was the 20th anniversary, and that was really, I found that really hard because it just seems like such a big number. And again, I would say years 16, 17, 18, I was like a bit sad, but like, oh, it's my dad's anniversary today.
I sort of get a rounded number and a big passage of time. I'm yet to, you know, I'm only 4 years since dad died, so I'm, yeah, so maybe I'll change my. mind about significant
things. It's so dependent on where you're, and I think it's what you interested in, what we talked about at the beginning, of like where you're at in your life as well, or like, you know, if you're very busy that day or something good is happening, you can kind of like buffer yourself a little bit and you can be like, oh, today is sort of like not getting me. But like you said, those and everyone describes it as waves. I think that's like a universal description of like, you feel it just like slap you in the face, and you're like, and I know that you're like, where the did that come from? Like, and you're suddenly sobbing. But I find the sobbing is a little bit shorter than it used to be. That's what I find. As the years go by, the sobbing used to be like a whole day. 20 years on, you'll do 5 minutes. You think, I feel better. I'm all right.
I had a really, and Barry talking about that moment, I've told you this. I had a really odd. Mm. I'm not at all religious. I'm sure you're going to come on to that at some point. Sure. But I'm not remotely religious. And I am. I feel fairly sure this is it.
Yeah.
And I had a weird thing when my dad died, because it was a hectic time for me, because weirdly I was writing a sitcom at the time where Rick Mail played my dad. He died, and so I was panic rewriting a sitcom.
Yeah.
And then 2 months later, my real dad died. So I had the old double dad death.
That must have been so hard.
And it was a strange period, because of course the people who paid for the sitcom were very kind and were sort of take as long as you need. But after a certain period, it's like, so no, you're better. Quite reasonably, so I had to get on with it. So, you know, I was with my family for the correct amount of time, and then I had to write it, and it was frantic. And something weird happened, and that is, because I was, like Barry, I was really close to my dad. You know, we had a very similar, I think, from us talking, we had a very similar relationship with our dads. And I forgot how he sounded.
Oh, yeah.
I forgot his voice, and I'm sure you've come across this before, but I couldn't remember how he sounded. And we had tape, so I could hear him. And I bet some of you have experienced this. I couldn't remember his bloody voice, and it drove me mad.
Nice.
And I only realised it after that frantic period of work was over, and I was on holiday, so 6-8 months after his death, and I went on a road trip with a friend across America, specifically Roisin Conti.
Yeah.
And we did a road trip down the one route up to San Francisco, and
I wasn't sitting there thinking, why can't I remember my dad's voice? But I had clocked it that I couldn't remember it. And we were driving along, and a swing song came on. And weirdly, I can't remember what it was, but my dad loved swing and had a very specific dance to swing that involved moving his fists like this. And just out of nowhere, he returned.
Wow.
I'll emphasise again, I'm not religious, and I don't think he in any way returned to me in spirit form.
Yeah.
But it was like my brain went, okay, you've had long enough now, here he is again. And I saw him.
Yeah.
I didn't see a ghostly apparition.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was so vivid that I saw him doing that stupid dance in front of me. And his voice flooded back into my brain, and it was so peculiar, and I did say I burst into tears, but it was very shortly followed by genuine happiness for me. It's so difficult not to speak in cliche, but it genuinely felt like I had him back weird way.
No, it's really, because I'm equally I'm not religious, and you know, especially when someone dies at 15, you sort of have this like, maybe they're in heaven, like that's what everyone kind of told me. So you're like a little bit hopeful, and then as you get older, you're like, I don't know, guys. It's like, and I know that experience that you're talking about. You're like, it feels like somebody's here, and that's a bit strange. And then it goes, and who the fuck knows what that is, but I had years where he definitely, oh, there he is. Hello. Don't test him, you see. The old glass trick. Dad, I'm in the middle of talking. That is so typical of you.
I had a glass, not a glass moment, but when I was on the same trip to America. Sorry, I've talked over you there.
No, God.
I just had this moment where I was staying in a hotel by a beach, and down on the beach there was this seagull looking at me. And then there was no other seagulls there, and it was like this. And I went, nah. and I went to the loo, and when I came back, the solitary seagull of fucking Cannery Row had flown onto my balcony and was sitting there with his head caught looking at me. And I swear, I stared at that seagull for 10 minutes. And I went, oh, pull yourself together. And the seagull flew off. But I genuinely thought if he was going to do anything, he would come back as a seagull and cock his head at me.
These weird moments. Have you had stuff like that,
though? No, but I did a gig in Bangor in North Wales once, and it was a really, really long journey with delays to the train, and it was cold. And you know, Bangor, that's some of that North Walian coast is beautiful in the summer,
but tough in the winter
when you're there out of season. And and the two most depressing things I saw, one was when I got to the B&B, they put me up in, and I opened up the curtains, and there was a dead seagull on the just outside on the windowsill. And I,
yeah, Dad told me he was going to do that. He was pretending. He was fine.
And the other was walking to the gig and seeing a one-armed man playing pool on his own. I don't know why. It just looked. There was something about that. After the seagull as well. There was just something just looks like, oh, you know, I look for a pub window. It's just grim. Playing pool on his own.
What do you think of your own funerals? Have you had any thoughts about that? Is there any like music you want played?
I have a thing about this.
Okay.
I sort of won't dictate to anybody how I want my funeral to be, and I don't really like other people dictating it to me. I don't.
Do you think it's up to the people who are left, basically?
Well, I think it's.
I think
everybody's got to. Every family's got to work it out their way.
Yeah.
But I don't want to be told to wear bright colours. Or to be happy at the funeral of somebody who I loved.
And it's
a thing of mine. It's sort of none of your business how I react at your funeral is how I feel. And you know, and I've been at funerals. I was at a funeral of a friend whose dad had died, and and she was wearing a big, bright, happy dress because she was told to, and she was clearly not happy. And I sort of think when I die, you know, anyone who cared for me, you can react however you want.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and but don't get me wrong. If you want to play the flute and wear a big dress, that's fine.
I'm going to do that, Greg,
good.
So you know.
Please.
I'm going to play the flute. I'm going to track down your family and be like, no, I told him this.
I am going to make sure you're invited.
To play the flute.
And I love the correct assumption that I'm going before you.
I think so. Barry, what do you think for your funeral?
I've got a weird thing about funerals and my dad insisted on not having a funeral.
Oh wow, yeah. Some people, Catherine Ryan said that as well. Mm. She's like, no funeral, nothing.
He insisted on it. And so he died in America and in California. And they have quite often. I think the way they work it is that you're cremated before the service anyway. If you were to have a funeral, I think that's the way around they do it. But we basically had a barbecue out there with that wasn't the cremation.
Whatever you want to do, it's free and easy. Californians are very relaxed.
Jesus Christ. I felt disrespectful imagining mine as a seagull.
a friend of mine had a get together, and it was just very, you know, we put a slideshow together. Then my brother came over about a week and a half later, and my dad, his only instructions were that he wanted his ashes scattered. He's everywhere, to be honest. He wanted some at the River Mole, where he used to go fishing years ago, near where we used to live. He wanted some at Spurs' ground, at White Hart Lane. And I called the...
you're not allowed, are you? Or did you sneakily... Everyone sneakily does it.
Well, this is my brother was only over, and there was a match while he was over. Yeah. So we got tickets for the match, and I called the Tottenham Hotspur press people, and I asked, they said, no, we don't do that, it affects the soil. Well, I don't think it does that, but whatever, right? So what we decided was, we're going to go to the match, and we took my granddad with us as well, and typically we end up getting seats, because we booked quite late, right up in, so we're trying to drag my 83-year-old grand up to the seats, and then, and we lost. We decided that if we couldn't get them to do it there and then, we would book a stadium tour the next day,
and we'd
do it like The Great Escape,
out of our
trousers.
Yeah, yeah.
Either way, we're going to do this. We go down to the steward, as the game's finished, we go down towards the pitch, and this guy, excuse me, you can't go down there. And my brother's going, I just want to get a picture from White Hart Lane. They go, no, you can't, can you stop, please, can you come back? And he seems like a bad actor. It seems like a sketch, and he's a bad actor. And my brother just walks down to the pitch, goes, come back here, and I'm filming the whole thing. My brother's just got a handful, and he just walks onto the pitch, and goes, come on, you Spurs, and he just releases his hand, and there's just a cloud of dad, and it was beautiful, it was brilliant.
So we
had it, and then I've still got some in a box that were just sitting next to the TV that I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do with.
My dad was in the wardrobe for 10 years.
Yeah.
For us, it was a big thing of like, you know, because you know he died young and we were teenagers. We just waited until I think we were all kind of ready, and then we went and just scattered them in Wales.
But your dad had specific.
Yeah, he did.
Weirdly, he didn't want the funeral, but there was some. So then his best friend scattered some of the golf club where they used to play, and was like sprinkling them on golf balls and golf balls. And he's everywhere. There was a bit on my sister. They put a bit in a pendant, my dad's best mate, for my sister when she got married, so that he was walking her down the aisle.
That's so nice.
Weird. He didn't want the funeral, but for me, I don't. I honestly don't care. And weirdly, and again, everyone does things differently, there's no judge, but part of me thinks it takes a certain amount of ego from some people who go, right, I'm having this, this and this, then this is happening, as if as if it's like a wedding planning.
Yeah,
I find it a bit bizarre.
And
music-wise, again, whatever anyone wants to do, I don't want people enjoying themselves too much, but music-wise, just none of the cheesy, like...
Wind Beneath My Wings. No offence if anyone has.
Yeah, no, My Way, Wind Beneath My Wings, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, Angels, Robbie Williams.
Yeah.
And the worst, I went to a funeral of a friend's dad who died, and they played The Long and Winding Road, right? but not the Beatles version, Gareth Case and Will Young. What is that? I couldn't believe it. I couldn't even, the whole, I was like, what?
Should I tell you what my, when my granddad, when my mum's dad died, they'd moved to Shropshire, where my family are from, and he was cremated, and then we were outside, and it was perfectly nice, send-off, and we were outside making polite conversation, and the funeral director was a real Shropshire bumpkin. He came over and goes, all right, Mrs. Davis, you happy with that? And she went, yeah, thank you. Thank you, John. That was really lovely. It was just how we hoped to say goodbye to him. He went, that's it. And then I saw in his eyes that's where his social skills ended. I mean, he's been a funeral director his whole life. Yeah. And he was a man in his mid-60s. But I could see he was going, that's all I've got to say, but I should say more. And there was a pause while we both stood there. And then he looked back at the chimney of the crematorium.
No.
And he thumbed it like that. And then he looked back at us and he went, we're having a bit of trouble with the burner today. I have never in my life. And my mum reacted exactly as you've just reacted. And it was her dad. She went, I don't want to know about that, John. He goes, No.
Can you keep that to yourself? Thanks, John. That's
the burner as well.
Oh, that is awful.
Sorry, just quickly, a comic there's a guy called, you might see, it was on the news, there's a guy called Ian Cognito.
Yeah, he just died, yeah.
Yeah, he died at a gig. It was a big shock. He died recently. I couldn't make it down to the funeral down in Bath, but I've seen all the pictures and spoken to people, and they really went. So again, this wasn't something that was planned by him, and it was for other people, but there was probably, I think it was like 250 odd people there, mm-hmm. and they went to the wake, and lots of comic. This guy was a real character as well, so yeah. And lots and lots of stories. You know, people like Jeff Green, comic, flew over from Australia for a funeral, and that was a real, that felt like a real coming together of friends and family. And they brought Robin to Hurst. He apparently turned up in like an old battered up builder's van with the coffin in the back, and they ran it as almost as a gig almost.
Yeah, yeah.
And that really, you know, from everyone that was there
felt they did it.
Yes,
that's what, in answer to your question some minutes ago, that's what I would prefer, is that the funeral is dictated by those that know you, rather than you handing out instructions.
I think it's...
For me.
I think it's... My dad didn't really say anything, but I felt like what we did, it felt right, because, you know, my mum made those decisions and she knew him pretty well. So, everything about it felt right, but it was just... You just have that slight lingering... Is that what he would have wanted with his ashes? Because you don't know.
You were saying earlier about when you were a kid and going, you know, fingers crossed there is a heaven. And I suppose in some ways, I'm not religious, and in some ways, and my dad certainly wasn't, and there was a real problem when one of the nurses was insisting on getting... So when are we going to get the priest? When are we going to get the priest? And I thought, he doesn't want a priest. And she kept on, and to the point it was angering my dad in the end, because she was very religious. Do you think that it is a lot easier for people who do believe in a heaven, because it always, my ex's parents quarries, and my mum kept saying to me, he'll be looking down on you now, and I said that's not a comfort to me. Secondly, because my dad was such a social person that would be torture. My dad was there, I was going all having a good time without me, he'd be gutted. So that wasn't, but I always wonder whether it is that, whether people, you know, who do believe in heaven and do, but it must be much more comforting.
Well, I think from my experience of speaking to people, it definitely offers a comfort, but it doesn't take away their pain and their grief. So they still have this unbearable pain, but they have this, you know, this end game is the wrong word, but like this sort of like, in the depths of my pain, they're in heaven. So there is always this...
And we will meet again.
Yeah, and we'll meet again. I find that really... I find that so hard, because for me, that's torture. That's torture to think I'm going to meet him again. And it might not happen. I have no... I think I cannot deal with that.
But also, I'd say to people that say that to me and say, oh, you know, he'll be up in heaven looking down at you. I'm going, what... Is he up there in the state he was in when he died?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No. His magic back to a few years ago when he died. Yeah. What?
He's at the peak.
I don't understand. How does it work? Yeah. So I couldn't.
And also saying that to a 15-year-old girl, can I tell you, is terrifying. But your dad is watching you. It's like, when? What is he watching? Yeah. I really don't want that because I'm doing some stuff with this guy. I don't feel comfortable with that. Like, it's really terrifying.
I think my dad would have been exactly the same as yours. Would be looking down from heaven. Seeing us having a good time, going, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Why are you having a good time? I'm not there. How can you be enjoying it?
Yeah. Horrible.
And he would have wanted us to be really sad at the
scene. Yeah, why not? You can be sad. Someone matters.
But you know, I think it must be a comfort. I imagine it's a huge comfort if you're a person of faith. And I'm about to say something so cliched, but I really do feel him with me.
Yeah.
And I know, but that's because I was lucky enough to know him so well.
Yeah, yeah.
My logic is I knew him so well that I know how he would react in every situation. And I know specifically how he would judge every person I ever meet. And his horrible little cynical voice is taking the piss out of everybody in my brain all the time. Do you remember, we shouldn't end what's been such a lovely chat by talking about Cracker, starring Robbie Coltrane.
We should, and we are wrapping up.
But there was an episode of that that's really lived with me, it was long before my dad died, where Cracker's dad, mum died in the series, and... the character, I can't remember who wrote Cracker, he's a brilliant writer.
Jimmy McGovern.
Had his character say, we spend so much time, I'm paraphrasing, so in the unlikely event Jimmy McGovern's listening to this, I apologise. We spend so much time worrying about, needlessly worrying, that when something real happens, like the death of someone that you love as much as we clearly loved our dads, it's almost, I think he used the word delicious, because it's so real,
and it's
so worthy of your time,
that
I think it does make you stronger, because it contextualises so much of the crap that you waste your time on. I'm not saying that in any way I enjoyed it, but there is something sobering about it, and there is strength in it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. And I think I also feel privileged that I was there with that experience. I lived it with him, and I carry that with me. I feel like I'm glad that I know that.
Yeah, you're carrying the torch.
Yeah, and that life is about death, and that's okay, and you survive it. Like, I think Jimmy McGovern was wise. That's a good word to end on. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for coming and sitting with us talking about death. Please give a massive round of applause for Greg Davis and Barry Castagnoli, everybody.
And Carriad Lloyd.
You can follow Greg on Twitter at GDavies. And you can follow Barry on Twitter at Barry Castagnola, and that's Castagnola. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. Please do join us there. We're always retweeting stuff and talking to people who want advice or just to communicate stuff about death. It's a really wonderful space to be in. The show was edited by Kate Holland with thanks to Whistledown Studios, and the music was provided by the Glue Ensemble. If you'd like more information about Loros Hospice, you can head to loros.co.uk, where they have information of the services they provide and all the charity fundraising they are doing and how you can support them. And remember, you are not alone.